Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 194 for May 3rd of 2013. A billion cars on the road today, a billion more on the way. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Another opening, another show.
Another show. Thank you, Mr. Bridgestone.
Gary.
Great having him on.
Here.
We got Gary Vasilash back yet again. This is terrific.
Young? Young?
What'd you guys make of the car sales that came out this month for last month?
And now they're saying they're flattening out.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think the market's slowing down because the SAR, you know, the seasonally adjusted rate, is it dropped below 15. It was like 14.88. And I think this is the third month in a row that the SAR has been dropping, and it wasn't supposed to happen this way.
But as somebody said, May is a good month for auto sales, so it may just all pick back up.
It really could. And in fact, the month itself was strong over, you know, up 4.5% over a year ago.
But boy, there were some surprises, huh? I mean, the numbers for Volkswagen. I mean,
Volkswagen dropped like a rock.
What happened there? I mean, just everything.
And I think they backed off their leases. I wouldn't be surprised.
The other one that was a big surprise, Toyota down.
Yeah, this is the second month in a row that Camry sales are down. And even Prius is down.
Prius was down, I want to say, last month, like 22%, or March, and in April down 26%. Those are big drops. I'm going on a daily selling rate basis.
24.1.
24.1, unadjusted. That's still a huge drop.
It's just right across the board. I mean, it's very surprising. Now, that said, Nissan had a tremendous month. I mean,
Nissan was up over a year ago. The prior month, remember, they had outsold Honda, but Honda clobbered them this
right.
month. But, you know, that's
so
making...
So Accord beat Camry, so, you know, that's a big one for them, that's for
right.
sure.
And you know, Honda's been trash-talking Toyota of having so many fleet sales
right.
with the Camry. So they're going to doubly pound their chest saying, yeah, not only did we beat Camry, we did it with all retail.
Right. And because Honda not believing in having fleet sales and trying to keep their residuals as high as possible. One thing that I spotted that, you know, Peter and I are big fans of the XTS, and that outsold the ATS this month.
Wow.
So not by much, but it was XTS 2891 versus ATS 2725. So, obviously, people are listening to us, Peter.
I think when people see the XTS on the road, they like it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but even so, those sales numbers are nothing to write home about.
No, you get more of them
on
the road.
Less than 3,000 each. I mean, didn't Lincoln do 4,000 with the MKZ? I mean, here's the thing that's been languishing, and then they finally get
volume. The dealers finally got them.
They finally got. Now, maybe there's been some pent-up demand, but, I mean, right out of the box, the MKZ outsells two Cadillacs that have been on the market for months.
I just had that a week or so ago, and that really is a good car.
Which one? The MKZ?
The MKZ.
I like it.
I was tremendously surprised. And now all they have to do is get a showroom full of cars like that, and maybe they have a chance.
Yeah.
I think they will get that showroom full of cars
yeah,
like
next
that.
Next up for them is the MKC.
Right, which we've seen at least the concept version of. It looks pretty good.
You know, one thing that really surprised me in terms of GM numbers, that GMC actually outperformed Buick. Now, and this is taking, if you take the Sierra sales out, because, I mean, that's not fair, right? Take
right.
a truck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You take that out. But you still have GMC outselling Buick.
Even with the Sierra out of the picture.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because GMC sold 34,799, and Buick sold 17,157. And so of the 35,000, 14,000 were Sierras. Take those out, and you're still...
Yeah, they're still... You know, one car that's just not working at all for Buick is the Regal.
Yeah.
That thing's going nowhere.
Down 38.8%.
See, that's a big drop.
That's because the Verano's too good. You know, they're just cannibalizing in their own showroom.
You know, it's another car that the Sonata is beginning to
right.
go down quite a bit.
Right. And, well, I think Hyundai's hit a wall here. And Kia definitely has. Kia is one of the few companies, the handful of companies that saw its sales go down
right.
yet again, 2 months in a row now.
But it's interesting. So calendar year to date for Sonata, this year, 63,362. Last year, 75,716.
I think the Sonata is yesterday's news. I mean, it's...
So Peter... To the point of, if you look at the design of the Sonata, so the Sonata basically threw the gauntlet down and said, okay, we're going to be design-led. We're going to have a look in the midsize segment that is unlike anything anybody else has. And they did that, right?
Right.
Now, does this mean that people are becoming very fickle in terms of saying, okay, we like that design, but now we don't. We want something new?
It's not that they don't like it. They just want what's newer. You know, I think, you know, let's face it, the automobile business is a fashion business.
And remember, the Sonata is the oldest car in the class
yeah,
right now.
It's the oldest car.
The oldest.
Class.
And it's only, what, 4 years old. So it's due for a refresh, which has got to be coming, what, next year or is it this year?
I think this year.
Yeah, and the what's new thing is probably going to work in Lincoln's favor with the MKZ. You know,
because they have something new.
Yeah, they have.
But you know, but it sort of strikes me that you know I would wonder that if I were sitting in an executive office right now and looking at what's happened, you know, with the Sonata, and saying, well, you know, do we maybe want something that is more restrained, more conservative, still fashion forward, but more tailored, more like the Fusion rather than like the Sonata, more, you know. Smooth, taut sheet metal rather than you know exaggerated folds in the sheet metal and so it could have a negative reaction on pushing forward more exotic designs.
Well, you know that design was highly controversial in Korea. They didn't like it. I don't know how well the Sonata has sold in Korea or not.
I don't know either.
But Kraftcheck was recently quoted as saying, look, that form language on the current Sonata worked brilliantly for them. They're not going to mess with it too much. But you raise a good point. So do you push it more? Do you pull back? What do you do with it?
Well, you can't stand in place. I think you have to keep moving forward. Otherwise, you're just going to get swallowed up by everybody else.
So I wonder if this would then portend, I mean, if you're going to do that, it would seem to me that you'd have to be ready, willing, and able to have much shorter periods between major refreshes. Therefore, I mean, you'd have to do something for the tooling to be able to do that and pay for it, right?
That, or I still don't know why the industry doesn't borrow a practice that they had in the not-too-distant past, where they might do the front end of the car and bring it out, and a year or two later redo the rear end and keep that kind of a cycle going where you're always doing something. Look at the new Toyota 4Runner. They put a new nose on it. The rest of the car is virtually identical to before. But that new nose is so different. It's very controversial, at least based on our viewer feedback. Nonetheless, even though it's controversial, I think they did the right thing. They got people talking about the new design.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's other tricks that you can play where you don't have to dump hundreds of millions of dollars into retooling a car. Or, you do this, let's redo the front end. This year, 2 years, we change that. 2 years from then, we redo the interior. 2 years, we got a new front end. And I think you can keep the mix going that way, too.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder what it would take organizationally for something like that to happen.
You just got to plan it in advance, you know, because back when Detroit was the master of doing the annual styling change, number one, remember, you know, Chevrolet had the Chevrolet. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get a two-door, a four-door, a wagon, or a, you know, a convertible. But It was that or the truck or the Corvette. That was their whole lineup. So it was, you really had one car to do every year. But it wasn't like they came out with the 57s and then went, oh, let's think about the 58s. They had already figured out the 58s, the 59s, and the 60s at that point. Mm-hmm. And they had this rolling cadence. And it was literally a refresh. They weren't doing a ground-up brand-new car every single year. And when you really look back at the guys at Fisher Body, they were the masters.
It was amazing what they did.
They took, you know, a rear quarter from an Oldsmobile, mixed it with a top from a Buick, put on front fenders to a Chevrolet, and boom, they'd have an all-new car without really retooling a whole lot. Mm-hmm. They were absolutely the masters of mixing and matching different panels to come up with totally unique looks.
So could the Malibu be brought back up to where it was by doing something like that? I mean, it's a case in point. I mean, you know, Fusion's eating its lunch. I mean, so, you know, they're talking about doing something, so it sounds like they want to do something radical, but how can you do that, right? How can you afford to do that?
Well, there's a couple of things I think that the industry could do. Number one is don't touch the sheet metal. Don't even touch the fascias, but go with totally different headlamps and tail lamps. Now, maybe you do have to touch the fascias at that point if you want to change it that much. But you can change jewelry on the car and change the look, or at least make people think, oh, that's got to be the new one, mm-hmm. because there's different things to it. But I think there's a lot of styling tricks that the industry could play. But let's talk Malibu, because that's a good one. Even when we saw it in concept form, I remember talking to you about it, Peter. We thought it was a little too busy.
Yeah. I mean, the previous Malibu was clean. And I remember Lutz telling me it's everything we know right now in a car. And then we were at the design dome, and they showed the next Malibu, and I was just like, what are you guys doing? I mean, the back end still doesn't look like it belongs with the front end.
No, it doesn't. And they tried to make the back end look like a Camaro, kind of, and they didn't pull it off. So,
well, when you see the new Impala on the road, I begin to think that it was influenced more by the new Impala, but still, it just doesn't work. It's not cohesive.
So my redo, cheap redo of the Malibu would be to attack the rear end, because I don't think it looks good at all, and change the grill inserts. And that way, at least if you looked at the front end, it would look different. You'd think, oh, maybe this is a new one, and just spend the money and redo the rear end on the car.
See, but I wonder how much that rear end contributes to the aero of that car, because, I mean, that was a very important area that they were spending a whole lot of time looking at. And it may be that it has to look like that to get the coefficient of drag number they need.
I don't think so. You know, the way that you get the aero good in the back end is you have a high trunk line, which it does. Chop it and then put sharp creases where you can on the sides for good separation points. And same underneath. If you can do something with the splitter or trying to treat the air coming out from out of the back of the car to not start tumbling as much. But other than that, you can make it look however you want. You know, maybe you go with tail light lamps that, you know, stretch across the length of the car. Maybe you go with vertical ones. It almost doesn't matter at that point.
Chevy signature, right?
Well, neither is what they got.
Well, aren't those supposed to be Camaro taillights? And aren't those supposed to be Corvette taillights? Yeah. Aren't they all supposed to be the same?
Yeah, something like that. The new Corvette Indy Pace car looks good. Nice color. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it.
They just showed it this afternoon.
So what would you do with the Malibu?
I'd redo the whole damn thing.
See?
You have a bigger checkbook.
I wouldn't start with, because if you start messing with the back, it's just, you know what, you know, yeah, we can do that, but if we do that, we want to kind of shift the C pillar, and then if we do that, then we kind of got to futz with the roof, and then pretty soon, just redo it.
So what's it cost to reskin a car? I want to say, I'm guessing, $15 million per die set per panel.
Mm-hmm.
Would that sound?
That's
about sounds
right, yeah.
About right. So
it's
you
a couple
got
hundred million.
Let's see,
maybe, you know, 150 million.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. 9, 10, let's say 11 major stampings for a four-door car.
So 165, 150.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
So 200 million by the time you
200 quit. Million, yeah.
But you know, what the hell.
Messing
just throw it in there.
Somebody changes something. Really? That's going to be another 10 million. Well, we need to have it done. Like Dan. You know, when Dan comes to Design House, everyone's like, oh, boy, here we go. Dan knows best.
One thing that struck me was infinity numbers, and they're making that the G sedan did really well and the G cars are doing really, really well. And the thing that I wonder about is, you know, this whole new naming regime that they're going to be going through. So from a marketing point of view, doesn't that really, like, screw things up? That if people are like, oh, that G car is supposed to be really good, where is it? Well, sorry, we only have a Q.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's a gamble. I don't know. Johann's trying everything, every trick in the book to, you know, he's rebuilding the infrastructure of the brand, and they're just starting over, really.
They really are, and they got a long road in front of them. But they have a pretty good product lineup, too. You know, from a product standpoint, they're miles ahead of where Lincoln is right now.
Well, yeah, no doubt.
But the question is, can they generate that brand cachet? That's what it's all about.
I saw one of those convertible SUVs today. Oh. I almost drove off the road.
The Cross Cabrio?
Yeah.
The Murano Cross Cabrio.
Someone had, like, personalized plates on it.
Of course.
And it was just like, I was just like, whoa.
That's got to be one of the rarest cars on the road. I've only seen one.
With good reason.
And with good reason,
But the weird thing is I've seen two in the last 5 weeks.
No kidding.
And it was just weird.
You don't have the sales numbers for that handy, do you?
For the Murano Cross Cabrio?
I don't think they break them up.
I don't think they do either. But I mean, so basically what you're seeing is probably the Snowbirds coming back with their...
Could be.
So let's see. Murano is down 20.1%. Month to month and calendar year to date, 21.5%.
Yeah.
And I don't know. We could blame it on a Cross Cabrio. I don't think they make that many.
I don't either.
Just be, you know, just whip out the Sawzall and take off the top.
It's got ungainly proportions.
Got ungainly everything.
To put it charitably.
Yeah.
So we got GM and Chrysler earnings, which prompted you, Peter, to go off the nut against Sergio again.
I really didn't. Everyone thinks I froth at the mouth when I write this stuff. I'm perfectly calm. He's a businessman. He's not a saint. He's not a savior. He's a businessman. And he got a great deal. And I just trying to remind the media of that fact and all the... You know, all the enthusiasts out there who think he's walks on water. No, he's a businessman. He was gifted Chrysler, and he's smart enough to know what to do with it. So,
well, it's interesting to me to see that the company that did not take government money here in town, Ford, had an awfully good first quarter, taking Europe and South America into consideration. Whereas the bankrupt guys who had all the debt taken off their books... both saw their profits go down quite a bit.
And when you really think about that, the debt taken off, they should be swimming in money.
Right.
That's why it's kind of scary.
It is.
Yeah, but it gets back to the point of product, though, right?
It's always about product.
So
Ford has great product, but, you know, GM has some good products, and so does Chrysler, or Fiesler. That's my new name for
it. Jeez.
But, yeah, you know, you have to remind yourself, hey, they had all their debt wiped out.
Right.
And, you know, now, yeah, they plowed it into product development.
Well, this is GM's year, right? I mean, they got, I can't remember how many new models coming, and they did. They had a big dip in their product cadence because of the bankruptcy, and this is the year. They're getting back to where they should have been all along.
Yeah.
So we'll judge it at the end. And Chrysler lost production mainly with the Liberty and some changeover with the Ram and the Grand Cherokee.
And they said their profits were hit because of the Grand Cherokee and the Ram.
Right.
Development.
But their cars aren't selling very well. Okay, I mean, we can't overlook that. I mean, the 300 is going numbers nowhere. Are down. Right. 200 is down.
The 300 is tired. I don't care what they do with it. It's tired.
The 300.
It's been around too long. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's only 2 years, I think, since they redid it.
Yeah, but it's...
It didn't work.
The overall proportion, shape, whatever, it's still been around a while.
Right.
Too long.
And LEDs can't save everything. I'm just getting so tired of seeing, to your point of, just change the headlamps. Seeing every car now driving down the road, it's just like LED, LED, LED. It's like, geez, somebody's got to come back with incandescent bulbs and it's just be like a whole breakthrough.
Yeah, like the retro Christmas bulbs, the big ones. Can't see shit driving down the road. I remember back in the day, you get a Cobra or something. Or a Corvette, and the lights were terrible.
Oh, you could drive faster than the light.
Oh, yeah, you overdrive your lights all the time. You'd have to go out and get Lucas or CBA, preferably CBA lights. And then it was like a revelation. You flipped on the CBA brights. It was just like, wow.
Right. Have a whole lineup of them on the front end of the car, just like the rally cars.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. It's interesting the way the media has canonized Sergio. I don't know what it is. I think in this town, in this business, people need to have that, I guess.
Well, you're way harder on him than I am because to me there would not be a Chrysler today. All those jobs would have vanished if he hadn't. He's the only one who stepped up. And, yeah, he got a gift. But I say thank God he did. All I cared about was, let's keep CTC open. Let's keep that place full of people working here because it would be devastating to this area to have lost that. So I'm grateful. I know you don't like them, but I'm grateful there's still a Chrysler.
I'm glad there's still a Chrysler, too, because all the people who were toiling away there deserve to be live to fight another day.
Yeah.
And the only reason they're successful or made so much money is because of those people.
Totally agree. And I think Chrysler's going to more than make up this, dip in its first quarter earnings. Because what are Ram sales up? They're like 40% or something, right? It's outrageous.
Ram sales are, for the month, up 49%.
49%.
Well, let's face it. The two domestic car companies plus the Italian-owned car company with the pickups and that's where the money is.
That's where it is, right.
Let's face it. You can have Zoomy cars all you want, but in America, you got to have pickups.
If you have
good ones, you're going to make a ton of money.
Right.
And a nice line of crossovers or whatever. So.
Right. But Gary raises a good point. Their cars are not selling well. The 300 is dead in the water. The 200 and the Avenger do okay, but it's all fleet sales.
Avenger down 4%, 200 down 6%. Mm-hmm. So they're just
kind of treading water.
They're treading water. The Dart did about 8,000, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. That's okay, but that's not where they expected that.
Dart's
car to
been
be.
A disappointment.
Yeah,
we talked about that.
Right? Yeah, we've talked about that quite a bit. So they got a car problem. Their trucks are, the Jeeps are off the charts. I can't believe that. Wrangler and Grand Cherokee, unreal. And Durango had a strong month, too.
Yeah, up 65%.
The numbers are still small, but that's a...
Yeah, 5,386 Durangos. But yeah, that's a great car. I just really like that a lot. In the interior of that thing, Klaus Busse, they just did a magnificent job on that thing. It's just like, everything you touch in that, that guy... put his finger on and got it just got it right. So do you become a truck company? Is that the way to success?
No, because when the economy tanks and
you got to have that balance
and you don't have housing startups and you got to have, but make no mistake where the real profits are coming from.
Make no mistake. But, look at what Ford's doing right now. Its cars are doing really good. Its cars are highly desirable. The residuals are on them are really good. That's what Chrysler's got to do. They got to get to that same level of mojo.
Yeah, but Ford's. They got a long way to go.
Oh, yeah.
They're touting the new 200, but, everybody's looking at their... Really? Yeah, Ford, you know, that discipline, that focus is paying off.
Well, I think it's also, it's a global effort. I mean, they're truly designing to an international market, and I haven't seen that level at Chrysler yet in their cars.
Well, those Alphas should be showing up any day now, aren't they?
They should be.
They're on the boat, Peter.
They're going to wheel off a 4C off a boat in on the East Coast at 11:59 p.m. December 31st. Just so Sergio can say, I told you I was going to have Alpha in here in 13.
Hey, why don't we take a quick break and get our guest Bob Purcell on the show. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Well, Bob Purcell, welcome back to Autoline After Hours.
Well, it's nice to be back, John.
We had you here, what, 2 years ago or something like that?
Yeah, I was actually looking back at my calendar. It was October of 2010. So about 2.5 years ago.
So 2.5 years ago, and you were telling us about, we have these great hub motors, and you just wait. We're going to really take on the world with them. And now here we are 2.5 years later, and you're about to go into production with these things.
Yeah, we sure are. And the real success story is that I am back, and the company is still alive. I never really understood the full magnitude of the challenge that you face with a startup. And then you can compound it when you talk about a startup company in the automotive industry.
But especially you. You spent your whole career at General Motors, you know, Mother Motors, where everything's taken care of for you.
Well, actually, truth of the matter, John, I was a technician and service manager for 13 years before I ever walked into an OEM.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I went to a technical high school. I mean, I was powertrain and electrical, working in shops, apprenticed at 15, certified at 18, service manager at 19. Early on, spent a lot of time around racing. We raced formula cars and unlimited class motorcycles. So
a whole lot better in our book, let me tell you.
No, but that's where I cut my teeth. I mean, I was in the shops until I was 28 years old. And then I went back to school, got a master's degree, and went to GM when I was 30. But, you know, most of my early experience was about as hands-on as you can get.
And then when you were at GM, you were in that building out in Troy, so you were sort of like in Skunk Works.
They gave me my own car company. I mean, basically, Harry Pierce was the vice chairman at that time, and I still remember when Harry offered me the position, and, you know, Harry had that very commanding presence and deep voice. He goes, Bob, we will make you the 21st century Henry Ford. And I said, well, Harry, that's a pretty noble ambition. I'll go for it. But no, the whole idea behind that group, it was called Advanced Technology Vehicles, was to create a car company within a car company that was specifically commissioned to produce at, albeit low volume, all the new technology vehicles that the company would offer.
So that was the EV1 that you guys...
I did the EV1, the S10 truck, but I also had the military vehicles, I had the alt-fuel vehicles, anything that was outside the mainstream high volume production fell under the jurisdiction of that group. So it was fun, and it was like a real car company. I mean, in those days, you know, I still had solid line reporting. It wasn't matrix into me. They actually worked, you know, for you. So I was having the time of my life. I mean, I still look back on it as one of the greatest experiences I ever had in the industry.
Well, the EV1 was a cool car.
It was a tour de force, technically.
But I thought most of that was done at AeroVironment.
AeroVironment did the original concept car called the Impact, but what our job was to take basically a very promising proof of concept that had come out of AeroVironment, Advanced Engineering, and GM R&D and convert it to a production car. So we changed 80% of the parts in that car from the original concept car to the production entity. I only had two carryover parts, the door handles and the radio.
Who's the guy that started that company? I'm blanking out on his name. AeroVironment.
Burt Rutan?
Yeah, Rutan.
No. It wasn't Rutan. No. Paul McCready.
Yeah, they were aerospace guys. I mean,
McCready, I call him the Da Vinci of America.
He was a prolific inventor, very, very outstanding engineer in a lot of areas. I mean, not just automotive and aeronautics. He was a very talented man.
Yeah.
But when you were doing that work, I remember there were a whole lot of guys that were sitting there, and women, who were just writing code, because I remember you're saying that basically whatever we come up with here is deployable across all matter of electrified vehicles, whether they're hybrid.
Well, you look at I was telling somebody this today, actually, came to visit me at Protean. You know, we started with clean sheets of paper. I mean, the first electric cars, I've been at this now for 20 years. I mean, that was 1994. You know, the first electric cars we had elevator motors and choppers. I mean, solenoids. Okay. And then we thought we really moved up in the world when we got the MOSFETs. Okay. You know, the IGBTs, you know, for power electronics came in later out of Delco Electronics. You know, they were first for other industrial and aerospace, you know, military stuff. And then we brought them into automotive. But we, that group actually created the use of all that core technology that is now commonplace in everyone's advanced vehicle platforms. I mean, we created battery control systems. We created, you know, motor control. You know, it was, it didn't exist. But what we had to do is get it to the point where it'd be reliable and durable enough to actually put it in a production product.
I always wish that GM had taken that three-cylinder Suzuki engine when it was still tied up with it and dropped that in as an option or gotten a little diesel out of Opel.
Well, you might remember, John, you know, we debuted the electric version of the EV1 at the 96 show, first in L.A., and then we came the next day, Jack Smith and I and a couple others flew to Detroit, and we unveiled the car in Detroit. 98, we actually showed a whole portfolio of EV1-based vehicles. And we had a CNG version, we had a hybrid version, we had a series hybrid version, electric version, and there we also debuted the nickel metal hydride battery. I mean, the original EV1s were lead acid.
Lead acid. No, yeah, I remember that. And I remember the nickel metal one actually got into production, right?
Yeah, we put it, in the
second generation. Very few of them.
Second generation
EV1. What we were doing, what people didn't realize, we were cycling the core component technology in the battery systems. Not, you know, the car was the platform that carried it. But we were on a two-year turn on the technology. So we started the program in 96 with a Gen 1 drive system, Gen 1 battery system. By 98, we were into full second generation components. They were roughly two-thirds the package size, half the cost. I mean, the target was in every 2 years, every turn, we cut the cost in half.
Wow.
So I had already, by 98, 99, we had already designed the Gen 3 hardware that was one quarter of the cost of what we had started with in 96.
Wow.
So, but that was the real story. And then, Gary, to your point, we were the real technical mission of the EV1 was to design the world's most energy-efficient vehicle platform. It wasn't to do an electric car. So every function of the car was optimized for energy consumption. And the concept was some of that technology, lightweight components, improved aerodynamics, would spin off into core vehicle applications. It didn't have to be an electric car. You know, basically, when you're dealing with the physics of efficiency, mass, aero, rolling, accessory, and driveline, it's the same physics. You know, it can find its way into different application, but same physics. But what I'm really here to talk about, John, is in-wheel motors. I love reliving history, as you know, but I'm on to my next adventure now.
And, tell us a little bit about that, because, you know, to bring the audience up to speed, it's been 2.5 years, okay. But just explain the concept of what is a hub motor.
Okay, well, this is actually what we call an in-wheel motor, IWM, and it's now recognized as an actual class of electric drive in the industry, okay? Our motor is actually inside the wheel. If you look at the motor, it is it's a motor 16.5-inch diameter, 4-inch axial depth. It's a permanent magnet machine, very high density, okay? At peak, each motor puts out 75 kilowatts. I mean, that's 100 horsepower, 1,000 newton meters of torque, okay? That's 738 foot-pounds per motor.
Per motor.
Per motor.
Per wheel.
So, per wheel, right, exactly. And it goes inside of a standard 18-inch road wheel, no special offset or any special design to the wheel. So if your vehicle packages a standard 18-inch road wheel, it will package our motor. And that's the real value proposition. I can take any car on the parking lot that has an 18-inch wheel, and I don't care if it's front drive, rear drive, all-wheel drive, I can turn it into a hybrid. I can turn it into a plug-in hybrid and keep your base architecture the same. You do not have to tear the car up. All the other electric drive systems that are out there, you have to design the car around the drive system. Our drive system, the Protean drive system, adapts to your vehicle. And that's why we believe it's going to be a very important play in the industry during what we call probably the most critical transition period from a propulsion technology standpoint that the industry has ever encountered. And I'll just walk you through the little elevator speech, if you will. There's a billion vehicles in the global car park today. It took 130 years to get there, okay, to have a billion vehicles in operation around the world. The next billion are forecasted to be on the planet in the next 15 to 20 years.
Wow.
You, because of the growth rates in these markets, particularly China, you are going to double the global car park in the next two decades. It is not just an unrealistic assumption, it is an impossible assumption that all of those vehicles can be purely powered by internal combustion engines. You can't support it from an energy perspective, nor can you support it from an air quality perspective. This is the time where electric drive, in its various forms, I believe, will actually go to scale. And when I say electric drive, not electric cars, the idea of adding electric-derived tractive effort to the vehicle platform, it could be supplemental to a combustion engine, you know, in some form like a hybrid. It could have, in addition to supplementing the internal combustion engine, it could also add a drive mode to the car. With our motors, because of the density of our motors, the power and torque density, when you package our motors, you can drive the car just on our motors. I mean, a pair of our motors at peak, you're talking 200 horsepower, 2,000 newton meters of torque. Okay, so we can drive on two wheels, particularly on an urban schedule. We can drive anything up through light commercial, even light commercial fully loaded. So what you'll do is create the real car of the future. We'll have selectable drive mode, okay? You bolt on our motors, you package a battery pack. That vehicle's in the city, at the push of a button, the driver's got it in electric drive mode. When he's out of the city, he turns the engine back on and he's hybridized. If he's doing, let's say, cruising down the highway where an internal combustion engine has its highest efficiency point, lightly loaded, cruising at, you know, basically just off idle with the transmissions we have today, you can run the internal combustion engine and not have the drag of the hybrid system. So at the push of a button, you select what mode you want the vehicle in. And people are finding this to be a very interesting proposition. As you know, John, you know, China has taken great interest in our technology.
You've got a partner there that's going to start building.
We're going to start building there, Protean itself. We closed a third round of investment, a Series C round, last summer in July. It was $84 million, and two of the three investors are Chinese venture capital group and a Chinese industrial conglomerate. And the Chinese government has really taken a keen interest in our technology. Why? We can preserve the vehicle fleets that their manufacturers are building, yet offer an electric drive option on that car when it's in the city, offer a hybrid version to save fuel, and we can allow the current vehicles to become the new energy vehicles.
So you know a lot of guys in this town.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And so here you are saying that there's keen interest in China.
Okay? Yes.
Not keen interest in Detroit. Interest in China. So what is it that you think is not being seen here that people really ought to get?
I don't think it's a question of people not seeing things. You look at the air quality issues and the energy balance in China. I mean, the need is there. I mean, it is a compelling need.
Except for one thing. China gets 70% of its electricity from coal. And there's several studies now, too, that I'm aware of that show if China really goes electric, their air quality is only going to get worse.
They've also committed to major nuclear power in the next 20 years. So while they're coal-based generation today, they're going to move very aggressively to nuclear. I mean, that is...
Oh, then we got to wait 20 years before the air gets...
No. Most of the lead time on bringing a nuclear plant on is approvals and permitting. It's not building the plant. So a lot of that, like I was telling you, you know, before we got on the air here, you know, the city where our factory is going in didn't exist 9 years ago. Today it's a million people. And every building in the city is less than 8 years old. You can do things in China because of the nature of their government and economy that you can't do in a lot of places in the world. When they commit, they'll go.
Electric cars just are not catching on. Anywhere in the world. China, here, Europe, anywhere.
Well, here's
just
here,
not working.
I get that question a lot. You know, where do the electric, battery electric cars play? I think it's they're definitely in the urban environment, and they're at both ends of the portfolio. There is going to emerge, I believe, a class of city electric car. It will be the only vehicle that will be allowed to be personally owned and operated in the city center. So it's not about the car. It's about freedom. If you want to set your schedule, okay, not be tied to a mass transit schedule, you will own one of these. So certain classes of people, that is going to be the preferred option. Okay.
So when you say city, I mean, are you talking about London, New York,
Well,
Paris?
Right now I'm talking about Beijing, Shanghai. I mean, you know, Beijing and Shanghai are over 20 million people today. The projection is in the next 20 years, they're likely to grow to 50 each.
Oh, man.
Okay.
I wouldn't leave.
Well, like we were talking earlier, some of the cities that we're working in right now are 8 million people. And we say, well, that's, it's a modest sized city in China. That's New York City.
Right.
But in China terms, an 8 million city. But I think you're going to see pure electrics on the city car end. And it's about the personal freedom to set your schedule when you're driving in the city. And it's going to be on the other end, buses. China has made a major commitment to electric bus. An electric bus system is a very good option for electric drive. Why? You know the route. You put the exact amount of battery on board that you need for the route, and they're always in regen mode. You think about the duty cycle on a bus, short acceleration cycle, coast down, short acceleration cycle, coast down. All that coast down is regen. That's all putting the power back in the battery system. So my belief is the pure electric, the battery electric, will be the smallest vehicles in the city and the largest. Everything in between hybridized. And I believe our system offers the best option, which is selectable drive mode. So when people say, are your motors for hybrids, are your vehicles for electrics? I say yes. Okay, but the real value is the ability to select the drive mode. Okay, our system, at the push of a button, you can drive that vehicle around in the city electric, but you can still turn your engine on outside the city and drive it hybridized. So it's not that you have a hybrid or an electric, you have both. And guess what? I can help you build it on today's platform. That's the proposition. That's what we're going for.
Isn't there a concern, though, that you're basically rolling around with two powertrains in your car rather than one?
Yes.
And so that adds complexity, and that adds expense.
But you're going to be in that position with any hybrid. What I say is that we provide more value to the operator out of those two sources of tractive effort than any of the other systems that are out there. With another billion cars coming to the planet.
That's unreal.
In at the outside, the forecast will say in a 20-year window. On the inside, it's more like 15. You're going to double the car park. A lot of those vehicles are going into the cities. That's where the people are, right? The other thing happening in this same time window is the urbanization of the world's population. Okay, today, there's about 50% of the people in the world live in major urban centers. That's projected to go to 65%. Two-thirds of people in the world are going to live in major cities in the next 15 years. It's very interesting when you look at, like, population growth and dynamics. We didn't hit a billion people on the planet till 1960. By today, 2013, we're 7. In the next 15 years, we're 9. So between 1960 and 2025, the population of the planet Earth increased 9 times. True statistic. 65% of the people that have ever been born since the birth of humanity are alive today on the planet Earth.
That's a great stat, and I'd never heard it put that way.
I mean, you don't realize the age we're living in. This is one of the most unique times in human history, and I believe it's going to be one of the most tremendous opportunities for the auto industry that the industry's ever faced. The amount of money that's going to be made in the auto industry the next 15 to 20 years will be unprecedented in the history of the industry with that level of growth. Unprecedented. The winners, though, are going to be the ones who can lead with the new technology, because that's what the governments are going to require. They're not going to allow hundreds of millions of more conventional vehicles to find their way into those markets. It's just not sustainable.
Well, I love your wheel motors because that makes it very easy to hybridize a car. You just bolt them in. Who's knocking on your door?
We just finished in the last 2 weeks. We had SAA here, which was a great show for us. Had a lot of people come visit us. And then I jumped on an airplane, went to Shanghai, Shanghai Auto Show, and we had an equal number there. I would say odds are we're probably going to start up in China first. You know, we're working with a number of different OEMs in China on various projects. We have built some concept cars already with Chinese OEMs. We're about to start some additional programs with both Chinese OEMs as well as Chinese-based JVs. So they're Western OEMs joint ventured with Chinese. And I think odds are that will be our launch market because, the need is there. It's not that they're any smarter or any more clairvoyant. You know, you look out your window in a city like Beijing. I mean, I was there late January for one of our board meetings, and I'm standing outside the hotel in Shanghai. I could not see the building across the street.
Wow.
It happened to be one of these air inversions that you could not see the building across the street. The people are now saying, the people are telling the government, you have got to do something about this. What I offer is a near-term solution. The cities themselves, the city governments in China, own tens of thousands of vehicles themselves. You know, a big city like Beijing, that city-owned fleet is over 50,000 vehicles.
So why doesn't Carlos Ghosn just roll in there and say, we've got all these Leafs?
He could.
Ready to go, you know.
If he's willing. But I'm not sure that's going to be, you know, but they are what they are. And I don't criticize the Leaf. I mean, it's a very fine engineered vehicle. But in the end, what you have is an electric car. Okay, what I offer is you still have your combustion car. You can drive it in a hybrid mode. You can drive it in electric mode. I'll bolt it on for you. Keep your car. Keep the car you like. The other thing is I can retrofit existing fleets. I don't have to go all new. So I can take a fleet of vehicles.
Do you have any customers seriously talking about that, retrofitting existing vehicles?
Fleet owners, not individuals.
Yeah. No, that's what the volume would be, fleets.
Yeah.
How do you brake these things? Put on the brakes?
It has a friction brake system.
So that's part of the...
Yeah, it's on the... If you think of it, first of all, just to describe the motor, it's an inside-out motor. So what spins is not, you know, a conventional electric motor, which spins is an internal shaft, which is hooked to your rotor, right? Our motor, the outer hub spins. It looks like a brake drum, but that is the rotor. The magnets line the inner circumference of an external, it's an external rotor motor. So you can direct bolt the wheel right to the motor. In the center of the motor is the wheel bearing. So it is, in some sense, a powered bearing. I mean, you've wrapped the motor around the wheel bearing, with the outer hub being the rotating element, the inner part of the motor is the stator and windings, okay? Mm-hmm. And so the brake is also an inside-out brake system. Rather than being a disc that emanates from a center hub, it's a disc that's on the circumference of the rotor. And so the caliper then faces out. I'm sure you guys are familiar with Buell motorcycles, like a Buell braking system. That's what it looks like. Mm. So... truth of the matter is, because our motors are such high efficiency, the regen rate is so high, you can do full stops with our motors. But there's no regulation that will allow a car to be put into commerce that does not have friction brakes. So we had to package a friction brake to comply with current standard. But truth of the matter is, our motors would on the rear would be sufficient for braking. And there's actually one very significant OEM who's built cars with our motors in Germany, who is testing the proposition of using our motors for rear braking. And you got to remember, our motors, you have individual torque control at each wheel. So some of the OEMs are working with, they want to make a handling package with it. I mean, it's going to be an all-out performance car, but remember, you can put exactly the torque input to that wheel that it needs for whatever you're doing. These things will go through a mini bike slalom. You can take a car through a mini bike slalom course.
All-wheel drive, all-wheel steer is what you're talking about.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
You wouldn't even need a steering wheel.
Yeah, but we built the car early on with Volvo Advanced Engineering, C30 platform.
Mind.
Okay, the first car we built called Volvo Recharge. It's now been taken out of service, but we built it with Volvo Advanced Engineering. We set it up to drive on a joystick. okay?
With no steering mechanism.
Yeah, it was still in the car, but we deactivated it.
You're turning just with the tires, front and rear.
Yeah. So it would be steer-by-wire, though. You just basically send commands.
Right, because what our motors take a torque command, not a speed command, okay? So they hook right into the can, just like an engine. I mean, it's a torque command. So it's very, and so with that, you have individual torque control on each wheel. But you can use our motors for superior handling.
Now, explain that a second. I got to stop you there because you're adding so much unsprung weight to the wheels.
31 kilograms per motor. But remember, this is on vehicles that...
Which is 65 pounds?
68,
68, okay.
But here's the thing. You're talking about a vehicle with an 18-inch wheel. Okay. It's not absolute unsprung mass. It's unsprung mass as a fraction of total mass, or unsprung mass as a ratio to sprung mass. Okay, so we're talking our motors go on full-size sedans, sport utilities, vans, crossovers, commercial vans, light commercial. As a fraction of total mass, it's totally manageable within the basic toolkit that you would use for ride and development. And
I know,
the guy who worked with us is Lotus.
But I can get in a car with wheels that are 4 pounds lighter, and I can feel the difference. And you're talking about putting 31 kilograms at each wheel.
You may be able to feel the difference, very trained operators, but in terms of meeting mass market requirements for ride and handling, you do not have to make any suspension changes with our motors on the class of vehicles that we package. If you want to go get in, if any of your listeners or viewers want to get into it, they go on our website, proteinelectric.com, and you'll see the study that was done by Lotus Engineering with our motors. And also, you probably know Damian Hardy from ProDrive, used to be at ProDrive. Damian's on our technical advisory board, and Damian also separately did a study on riding. We put a lot of attention into the unsprung mass question, and we've actually presented some papers here at SAE and other forums about how that it is manageable within the basic ride and handling development toolkit, bushings, shocks, don't have to make any geometry changes.
Because I got to believe if you're yanking out the differential and rear axles on a rear drive car, it's a wash.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly when we've got our motors on the rear, a lot of our applications are probably going to be first applications. They're front drive platforms with our motors on the rear. Hmm. So what you do, you create an all-wheel drive option on the car. You create an electric drive option on the car. You create a hybrid drive option on the car. And you can move that car up. You were talking about sales earlier. You can give that car a very special statement. The other thing you do is you add 200 horsepower. Okay?
Now you're talking.
So as we talked the last time I was here, this is an electric supercharger. I mean, these motors, and we've had discussions and worked on some concepts with some of the guys actually around here. You could put this on a 500-horsepower pony car, and you now got a 700-horsepower pony car, and you don't burn one more drop of gas. It's an electric afterburner. I mean, literally, just set it, light her off, and go. So it could be some fun.
What happens if one of the motors craps out?
Very good question. The two secret sauce elements in this motor, one is what I already described. It's an inside-out motor, external rotor motor. The other is it's not a single motor. What's inside of that ring are sub-motors, okay, that are hooked to a common bus. You can fail up to half the sub-motors and still not create enough of a torque interruption that it becomes a safety issue for an operator. Okay, so it has, because of the unique nature of the sub-motor architecture, it has built-in safety, designed-in safety, and that is one of our big selling points. We just presented a paper here at SAE a couple weeks ago on that very concept, which before I get off, I know my guys will get upset if I don't mention. We're a technology company. We're not a tier one, and so we put a lot of emphasis on our intellectual property and protection. When I was here last, John, we had about 12 patents in our portfolio with roughly 40 pending. Today we've got 27 patents that have been approved with 84 pending.
Wow.
Okay, so we really put
a some IP in this.
Yeah, but our business model, we're putting this first factory in China, and it is a lead factory build, relatively nominal capacity by automotive standards. It'll be capable of two lines. Each line would be able to build 50,000 motors. But because you use two or four motors per vehicle, that equates to roughly 20,000 vehicles. That's all the capacity, wholly owned capacity, we will ever have. Anything beyond that is licensed. So the discussions I'm having with potential customers as well as new investors is a licensing model. You know, you will have a part ownership of the core company and the core technology, which gives you access to the ongoing technology improvements, but you will also secure a license for production at high volume. And, you know, so, and we won't be licensing off a PowerPoint presentation. I can take you to our factory and show you in miniature scale the exact operations, machinery, and equipment you would put in your high-volume facility. I will have runtime data, quality data, cost data, you know, off of my line that is believable. I'm not trying to, you know, do what we used to call prints in a box for licensing, not PowerPoint licensing. I can show you an actual functional operation. The other advantage to my licensees, I'm starting up the supply base for them. For me to build motors, even at, you know, 50,000 units a year, I got to have all the parts coming in. I will have, and I'm going to be sourced within the first 2 years of production, over 90% sourced in China. And one of the big advantages, we're permanent magnet motor. All the rare earth elements come out of China.
Yeah, they sure do. They sure do.
So there's a lot of advantage to our licensees. I mean, I'm going to actually start the, you know, start the business for them, and they would then hook onto that and take it to scale. But that's our model. We're a technology company, a licensing company. We're going to remain very modest balance sheet. You know, I'm venture capital backed, so believe me, the kind of return numbers they look for, you never see in conventional automotive. I mean, so
hey,
it's fun.
This is a good time for us to segue into getting questions from the audience. This is what we call a rapid fire. Ben, let's get it up there.
All right.
And we got a bunch of questions that have poured in here. BRM Chris says, are there OEMs in North America looking for this, particularly commercial vehicles?
Yes.
Good.
We have not, believe me, I'm not excluding anybody. We've had great discussions with both North American-based OEMs as well as other companies that sell some of their larger product here in North America. If you want to seriously go after the new fuel economy standards, particularly on the trucks, you bolt on a pair of our motors. You're talking about 25 to 30% fuel economy improvement, and you don't have to touch the truck.
Rum Tum Tum wants to know, early adopters going to be commercial or military?
Not military. It'll be commercial. Probably first applications will be fleet.
Wright Knight wants to know, could a hub motor become a generator with another drive going through?
Absolutely. It's a high-efficiency electric machine. It works at high efficiency in both directions. Absolutely right.
Kip and Akron wanted to know what the motors weigh. You already answered that.
31 kilograms.
Yeah. AM2 wants to know, which cars will be using this?
If I was able to announce our first applications, this would be the perfect venue to do it. I'm not in a position to do that yet. I'm getting close.
London, England also asked about unsprung weight, but
yep.
You asked...
On the unsprung mass, I really encourage people, go on our website, proteinelectric.com, and there's a whole section in there on unsprung mass, and you can read the actual studies themselves rather than me speak, you know, for them.
Scott in Cleveland says he would have loved to have seen that next-gen EV1.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that program. But as I told one of the business magazines here a couple days ago in an interview, I'm not going to quit till I get an electric drive system to high volume, and I think this is the one that's going to make it.
We've got a couple of phone calls. Ben,
sure.
Let's bring one in.
Hey, John, Rick from San Diego. Yeah, as far as the Malibu and Regal, there's a real easy way to fix them. It's price. The value of those is just uncompetitive. The feature price value of the Malibu is just uncompetitive with the Accord Sport, especially the new Accord Sport, which is about the only one I see around here, the new ones. Camry, same thing. SEs, that's the trim level that this sells here, especially now. It used to be the LEs, now it's the SEs. Kia Optimus, neighborhood, all the young kids are buying them because of price, features. It's just way better than the Malibu offers. That's really its only problem. It's not the rear seat room. It's not the styling. Of course, it could be better, but it's just price. That's what sells in the segment. It's price, 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 price. And so the Regal's the same problem. There's no reason for a $10,000 difference between base price between a Malibu and a Regal. Regal should start about $5,000 is more than enough difference. It would help GM's revenue problem, which is why they don't make money. You got to make sales to get revenue to make profit.
Okay, what was the question again?
The point's well taken. You know, change the price. Nissan just restated all its pricing for the very same reason. They weren't showing up on web searches when people would set a base price. Brian wants to know, is your electric hub system feasible for Class 8 trucks?
No. We don't go up into that range. These motors don't have enough output. The issue is launch torque. When you get into really big, heavy vehicles, you know, to overcome that at-rest position, you got to throw a lot of torque into the wheel. And these motors, while they're very impressive at 1,000 newton meters, you need, like, for instance, for a city bus application, you'll need about 10 times that.
But you're doing city buses.
No, we're not doing buses. We're doing commercial delivery trucks, vans and things. We're not big enough for a bus.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 18-inch, you know.
Question for Peter, also from Brian. What are your thoughts about Mazda's new ad campaign entitled Game Changers? And do you think they should have kept Zoom Zoom?
Game Changers is a little optimistic. I have to spend some time with it more. You know, people have fondness for Zoom Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
But a Game Changers kind of leaves me cold.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, I see we got another phone call coming in. Let's get to that.
Hey, message for Bob Purcell. Hey, Bob Purcell, Len Fedorik from Washington, D.C. How practical is this system to convert vehicles, let's say, like United States Postal Service vehicles that run standard milk runs? Have we worked out the metrics yet, what it would cost to convert an upfit? Thanks.
Yes, it would be absolutely ideal for that type of a fleet application. The Postal Service, as you probably know, has taken multiple runs at getting to electric driving. Even back when I was in GM, we submitted proposals. This would be ideal because you can preserve the vehicle. You don't have to tear it up. I mean, you can bolt it on. So the answer to your question is yes. Our motors, even at the rate of production that that I'm talking about in our wholly owned factory, our motors will sell for about $1,600 a piece. Hmm. Not $16,000, $1,600. So you're talking about, you know, $3,000 worth of motors. The big cost element in the conversion will be the battery pack, not the motors. So, these are going to be, and as we drive to higher volume, particularly with the licensees, that cost will come down from there. That's actually a selling price number, not a cost number.
Do you have any preference in terms of battery?
No, it has to have sufficient energy or power for the given application. But we are, as we say, battery agnostic, you know, as long as it's got sufficient energy and power output. For the vehicle requirement, we can manage it with the motor.
Yeah. Well, really interesting. You're going to have to come back and be on the show again once we get a chance to actually drive these things. That's what I'm dying to experience.
Well, you've driven some.
Well, I've driven,
some of them, yeah.
You had an
F-150?
F-150, which was actually very impressive.
Yeah.
Because you rip out the engine and the axles and the differentials.
Well,
nothing under the truck.
Okay, the two cars you want to drive, you know, we did three E-Class Mercedes vehicles for Frankfurt in 2011. We built them with Brabus, one of their upfitters.
Mm-hmm.
And we had... Those vehicles are now out doing test drives. I've got one of them in China. I've got two of them in Europe. You want to drive the E-Class EV. There's four of our motors. Okay, it's 127 mile an hour top speed, Autobahn capable car, 56 kilowatt hour battery pack. I mean, every cubic centimeter that doesn't have interior volume or motors has got batteries in it. But it's an impressive car. And then we also built a hybrid version of the E-Class. The German government supported that program. The interest was potential conversion of the taxi fleet in Europe. Okay? Uh-huh. You can run a powered axle through our motors. So you can have them on a rear-drive vehicle, you know, with the motors on the rear. And you can blend the electric and the combustion-based traction, or you can have one or the other. With the way our system works. So the idea is when the taxis were in the city, they'd be driving electric, and then they could turn the engines back on outside of the city and drive them as hybrids.
Very interesting.
But
is that going anywhere, that effort?
We're still working on it. We're still working on it. There's been we've gotten a lot of attention. In addition, I'd have to say the second highest level of attention we've gotten outside of China is Germany.
Very interesting.
We're working with have done projects and are doing projects with all the German automakers.
Well, Bob Purcell, thanks again for coming back on.
Thank you for having me, John. It's always a great time being here. Appreciate it.
And Gary, good having you as always.
Thank you, John.
And my co-pilot, Peter,
Jen.
Good having you here. And
nice.
I want to thank everybody who tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.